It's summertime, and it's already getting very hazy out there in the culture. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you in the studio. We've been doing some reruns the last couple weeks. It's good to be kind of clearing the deck for some new information, although the stuff we ran was pretty important stuff. We ran last week, we ran a primer on Christian economics. And I think that's an important thing. That's something that a lot of Christians don't understand very well and need to think about. And so we provided some of the fodder for that thought.
Oh, absolutely, Chuck. I mean, again, we call them bests of for a reason, not because we sound so great, but because some of the information in there is actually vital to hear more than once. So, folks, hopefully that everybody was bearing with us and being long-suffering, I guess, Charles, while we were away. But we're back, and we're going into summertime, Charles. Spring's about over with, and we're getting ready to put on that summertime mentality where, you know, we're going to be doing, you know, whether you're still working regularly or not, whether you sometimes teachers don't, you know, have summer off and others don't. So, but we're going to be getting into that time where a lot of people are going to be out and about and engaging people, whether it's on vacation or just getting out in your yard more and getting in your neighborhoods more. And Chuck, pretty soon, conversations are going to turn to probably a couple, three major issues. And the first and foremost issue, sadly, though, not the least important issue that people I think are going to be talking about this summer is, will you or will you not vote for the two nominees for president? And I say the two, meaning just the two major parties,
because the vast majority
of people out there have no clue about the other folks who are on the ballot. And we talked about a couple of them during a previous program, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party and Daryl Castle of the Constitution Party. But, you know, that people are going to be asking, you know, if you run up to your neighbors and you know, you see a Bernie sticker, a Feel the Burn sticker on the back of their car, it's like, well, will you vote for Hillary Clinton or not? Or if you know somebody's a Republican and, you know, they supported like maybe a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, the question is, will you hold your nose and vote, pull the lever for Donald Trump? Because right now, Chuck, as it stands after Tuesday night of this week, with California and New Jersey, I believe, both having their presidential primaries, it's fairly obvious at this point right now that those two individuals are the highly likely presumptive nominees of their major political parties, Trump for the Republicans and Hillary Clinton for the Democrats. There's really not anybody organized enough to oppose the Trump ascension to the nomination, although they're trying desperately. The last known attempt here over the last couple of weeks by Bill Kristol and some others in the neocon movement to anoint a writer for National Review and a cultural thinker, and I have to note, a Calvinist, Chuck, by the name of David French, kind of fell flat on its face when French came out and said, although I'm flattered by the attention, there is no way that I'm going to put myself forward to be a nominee for president or run on an independent ticket. So that one died in the cradle, as they say. And so the Republicans really are faced with the choice of going into their nominating convention in the middle of July in Cleveland, Ohio, having to swallow hard and accept Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president for November. The Democrats, on the other hand, have an interesting conundrum on their hands because they do have somebody who is capable and organized and willing to keep putting up opposition all the way through to the convention that they're having the week after the Republican convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and that's the Bernie Sanders campaign. It was funny, Chuck. I noted this earlier this week. that, you know, California's primary was on Tuesday, but on Sunday and Monday, the media was falling all over themselves, loudly and repeatedly claiming that Hillary Clinton had cinched the nomination already prior to California. Now, whether that was really accurate or not, because, you know, they do deal with these superdelegate issues in the Democratic Party, and so you never really know for sure if there's, you know, accurate or not that all the superdelegates are going to go with Hillary. The point is, the media, I think, was trying to mute or suppress the Sanders vote in California. I'm not so sure that they were quite as successful. I mean, I think Hillary did win California yes. Tuesday night.
Handily, I think, yeah.
But I saw a note here from a couple of places that her vote totals in California in 2016 were at least 30% lighter than they were when she ran in 2008 in California. Now, that signals some difficulty in the Clinton campaign, because California is a fairly reliably liberal state where Democrats usually clean up pretty handily and win, you know, all of the 54 or 55 electoral votes that California offers during a presidential run. But if Bernie Sanders, and I honestly believe, I watched an interview with him on a cable show here last week, as a matter of fact, Chuck, and I honestly, he truly believes that he's taken this fight all the way to the convention because it's a matter of principle for him, and the principle is that the party should not be controlled by the insiders. Now, interesting, because now you have in both parties a wing saying the party shouldn't be controlled by the insiders who have nominated or who want to nominate someone who has been an insider.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What's interesting about this whole Bernie thing, you know, you mentioned the two sub-major political parties, the Constitution Party and the Libertarian Party, Gary Johnson for Libertarians and Daryl Castle for the Constitution Party. Bernie's actually talking about cranking up a third party or an independent run effort. Now, what will be interesting to see is if this happens, whether in some states the law, the sore loser laws, will be ignored. Because you and I both know, working from the conservative side in third party politics many years ago, mm-hmm. that oh no, man, those things get enforced to the hilt with conservative parties. And in fact, sometimes they're interpreted extra legally to add provisions that aren't actually in the laws, by interpreters of those laws, like the secretaries of state and that kind of thing. However, it's been my experience in the past, having worked in third party movements long, long, long standing, that liberal third parties are often given a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And are sort of, we'll let you go ahead and we'll give you ballot access, or we'll do this or we'll do that. And it'll be interesting to see how this pans out if Sanders decides to, try get around those laws. We can talk about, for instance, you know, somebody might bring up the old, what's his face? The guy with the jug ears that helped get Bill Clinton elected. You know who I mean. Ross Perot. People say, well, Ross Perot got ballot access. Ross Perot got ballot access because he was always with the Reform Party. He never tried to run under one of the major party tickets.
Ross Perot.
That's right. Ross Perot always was a third-party guy because the Reform Party had been around. If you'll recall, that's about the era mm-hmm. when Jesse Ventura got elected governor of Minnesota.
Right.
Beat out Hubert Humphrey's son and somebody else. Hubert Humphrey's son running as the Democrat, and I can't remember who he beat as the Republican. What's interesting about that is that Jesse Ventura's life was made miserable by the legislature. Neither party would work with him on anything, which I guess we shouldn't be surprised about. both resented, both parties resented him greatly for, as an interloper. How dare you get involved in our little game? You came in and got us thrown out of our own game. Well, and that's kind of the attitude. And Bernie Sanders is playing that a little bit. Bernie Sanders has never actually been a Democrat. He ran under the Democratic ticket. He had to come over. He's always been in his political life. They've called him an independent. He's a socialist. He's called himself a Democratic socialist. And the only reason he's run as an independent is because Democratic socialists can't get a ballot line. That's the bottom line. There isn't any really... I mean, I've seen socialists on the ballot from time to time. It's sort of like seeing the Green Party on the ballot from time to time. But it's not a continuous thing. So Bernie's always run as an independent. Even, you know, he started out as mayor of Burlington, I think, Vermont.
That's true.
And ended up in Congress, and then he went from Congress to the Senate. And always as a quote-unquote independent. And we can thank Tip O'Neill for part of that, because he should have had an S next to his name, which was socialist, and instead he had an I. And that was because Tip O'Neill basically demanded it, but he always caucused with the Democrats.
Yes, of course.
Some of these designations are merely PR, public relations, but it'll be interesting to see what Bernie does after the convention, because the chances are that convention is going to be raucous, as it looked like the Republican convention was going to be raucous. Well, I think it will be raucous, but it'll be raucous outside the hall.
Right.
The Democrats will be raucous inside the hall. So it'll look more like 1972 instead of 1968. The Republican convention will look like 1968. Democratic convention where the riots were outside, and the Democrat convention will look like the 72 convention where the riots were inside the hall.
Well, I know I'm not making any summertime vacation plans to go to either Cleveland or Philadelphia in July.
No. Well, you shouldn't go to Philadelphia in July anyway. If you've ever been there in July, it is not a pleasant place to be. There's a reason why when the seat of government was in Philadelphia, everybody went back to the farm, because A, it was just unbelievably sweltering hot, and B, people died because yellow fever carried by mosquitoes from the swampland that surrounded Philadelphia made life just, you know, overly hot temperatures and mosquitoes bearing illness just made things unbearable there. So that's why Gary DeMar wrote the article that said the worst thing that ever happened to Washington, D.C. and to the United States of America was the invention of air conditioning, which allowed Washington, D.C. to stay open into the summer months.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's going to be interesting because the Democrats are going to have a tough time on their hands in their convention. First of all, trying to get Hillary in without a fight. Secondly, trying to keep Hillary in through November without an indictment because of the issues that are surrounding her term as Secretary of State. So there's an awful lot that's going to be happening in that hazy summer months here going into July, August, and September that can be for some interesting fodder. And of course, knowing the severity of the issues that could be popping up, Bernie Sanders may be very, very well emboldened to continue to press on for a non-party candidacy and be the stalking horse against his own fellow travelers in the Democratic Party. I know full well that one of the concessions that they're looking for is for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is the DNC chairwoman, to be summarily removed from her position.
Debbie is going to suffer a defenestration.
Indeed, one way or the other.
Yes. Now, if you don't know what a defenestration is, it means being thrown out a window. It's a very interesting political practice that was done in places that are now Czechoslovakia. It was called Bohemia. And unpopular political leaders were generally, a mob would break into the office and throw you out the window if they didn't like you. And usually, you know, those offices were like on the second or third floor. So very often the person was injured badly or died. And we don't think Debbie's going to have that particular problem, and it's not going to be a literal defenestration, but that's basically what they're going to do.
Yeah, well, it's probably a lot nicer for you than a debalustration, which is where they take you to the inside of the third floor and throw you down the stairwell.
Down the stairwell, yeah.
Oh, my. Well, anyhow, so, but on the other side of the coin, like you said, I think the, and other than outside with protesters, I honestly believe that the inside of the Republican National Convention, which we originally thought might be a very wild and dangerous place to be, is going to be very sedate. I mean, you've even got people like John Kasich and Rob Portman who are out there publicly saying that they're not even sure that they're going to go now to the Republican National Convention in their home state. And I think that's interesting for two reasons. I mean, number one, John Kasich was running against Trump and he got so soundly defeated. And it's fairly obvious by this point that John Kasich is not on Donald Trump's shortlist for vice president. And so, you know, if you're not even planning on going to the convention, that means that through the back channels, you've been told don't even expect it, John. It's not happening. And Rob Portman is in a three-way primary, or not primary, but a three-way general election now to retain his U.S. Senate seat. Now, people are like, what do you mean three-way? What do you mean? Wait, three-way? What's that? Well, Portman, who's the incumbent Republican for the U.S. Senate, is running against, this is the person everybody knows who's paying any attention whatsoever, against former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland, who's running on the Democratic ticket for him. And, you know, the barbs are being jabbed and the mud's being slung back and forth between them are starting to. But lo and behold, Chuck, and this is news that most people don't even know about yet, quietly during the primary, the Monday before the primary, there was a filing done with the Secretary of State for an independent candidate for the United States Senate seat. That independent candidate is Tom Connors, who is an attorney from Akron. In the interest of full disclosure, I've known Tom for 20-plus years. He's pro-family, pro-life. He worked with us early on as we were developing all kinds of good pro-family legislation in the House back in the 90s. And he just felt like people needed to have an alternative and that nobody was talking about the key social issues of the day. And you certainly wasn't going to get any kind of a differential on the issue of marriage between Ted Strickland and Rob Portman because no. They're both pro-gay marriage.
Right.
Tom's not. Well, Tom filed his people collected signatures for him all throughout the winter and going up into the spring so that he could file his papers on the 14th of March. And the Secretary of State checked all of his filings and checked all of his signatures and certified that he had enough signatures to appear on the ballot in November. And so, therefore, you do have another option if you cannot support Rob Portman, who has, you know, flip-flopped on marriage issues and been a very strident voice now against, pro-family values when it comes to marriage. Or Ted Strickland, whose entire administration was centered around doing things in the progressive left. You have another option of Tom Connors, who is running as an independent. He probably will not get a lot of media play, and he won't get a lot of opportunities to get into debates with these guys. But for those who want to hold their vote valuable, you do have another place to put it. Now, there may be more than him. I don't know, Chuck. I have to look and check the Secretary of State's website to see if anybody else got on the ballot in that race. But I do know, because I got some information just the other day, that Connors did, his positions were certified, and he will be on the ballot in November.
Interesting. Okay, so basically I may not have to sit out on the Senate race this next time around. There's someone at least to examine for the worthiness of a vote. Yeah. We don't endorse candidates on this show.
Yep.
But at least there's somebody I can look at, which is a good thing.
No.
Which is a good thing. Because in many cases, I have to, I don't hold my nose and pull the lever. As you well know, I just don't vote. If there's somebody that's not worthy of my vote, I don't vote.
Right.
And people have, but you gave us such and such and so and so. I go, no, I didn't. No, I gave you nothing. I gave you the opportunity to get someone else in the job, and I worked for someone else who was worthy of my vote in the job, and when they didn't get it, I just said, no, I'm not going to vote for someone who has no discernible difference between the other candidate, who right. also I can't stand. So every once in a while, you run into a situation where it's like it's Mox Nix. Which one do you pick? They're both okay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's a rare situation, and it's getting rarer all the time, but occasionally you're sort of like, now who do I vote for?
Well, and we actually had one of those situations come up, Chuck, in the primary. And as a matter of fact, that segues right into the next thing I wanted to talk about, because we're recording this on Wednesday, June the 8th, and just yesterday, not only were five states doing presidential primaries, but Ohio had another election. Most people didn't know about it because most people couldn't vote in it. But it was the what we would call the general election to fill the unexpired term of one now retired John Boehner for Congress in the 8th congressional district here in Ohio. Now, we had a significant primary in the spring in March where you had about I think 11 or 12 candidates who were running for the seat for the nomination for the primary. You had an interesting thing where you had two votes you had to make because one of them was to pick a candidate to stand in the special general election, which was going to be held on Tuesday, the June the 7th, and then another vote in the primary to pick the candidate who would stand for the general election for the new term that would start in 2017, which will be held in the November general. Well, Troy area businessman Warren Davidson won both of those primaries. And just yesterday, Chuck, he won the special general election in the 8th congressional district to fill the seat of the retired John Boehner. So the 8th congressional district will now have, as soon as they can get it all done and certified and get him to D.C. and get him sworn in, they will have a congressional representation again for the first time since, I think it was, early December that that John Boehner stepped down. And so the 8th Congressional District has not had a representative casting votes for them for over 6 months. Well, that's going to change, and it's changing radically because Warren Davidson is pro-life, pro-family, pro-limited government, and actually was endorsed by the chair of the House Freedom Caucus, Jim Jordan, who helped him get elected. So, but in that primary, you had three or four guys who were probably pretty solid and who would have been, you know, consistent votes. But I think the voters wanted someone who wasn't just consistent, but who would stand up for their values. And Warren Davidson now is going to be taking the seat of John Boehner to fill out the term for the rest of this year and will be standing in November. And I think he might have a Democratic opponent in November. And I'm not sure if it's the same individual who he just ran against for the special. It probably is, which means he's probably going to win a full term come November. And I would just have one piece of advice for newly minted Congressman Warren Davidson from the 8th District, and that is don't take John Boehner's phone calls.
Yeah.
Or schedule meetings with him, because they will be desperate to try to link you back to John Boehner and for John to become your quote-unquote mentor to help you grow in office. And honestly, from what I've met Warren Davidson a couple times, I've talked to people around him, I think he is the real deal, Chuck. He's somebody who understands his faith, he understands his constitution, and he is wanting to go and work for the best interests of his district. And something that they haven't had in a long time with John Boehner.
Right. And, almost anything would have been an improvement over Boehner. Unfortunately, that Cincinnati area has a reputation for being conservative, and when you actually look at the voting records of a lot of the reps down there, not so much.
Right. Well, I mean, honestly, the most conservative reps in the Cincinnati area in Congress, it wasn't John Boehner, and it isn't Steve Shabbat's probably about as conservative as they've got right now.
Yeah.
And that's even questionable. It's very Brad Winstrup, who's like a newer, I think he's in his second term, started off, everybody thought he was great, he's going to be a great conservative, and he started voting with Boehner right away.
Yeah.
Which isn't a conservative track record. Now, will that change now that Boehner's no longer wielding the power pressure of being the speaker? I don't know. We'll see. But I think Davidson is already, you know, he's going to align himself with Jim Jordan and with the House Freedom Caucus folks, who, if they continue to keep adding members like they do, Chuck, they're going to fulfill our long-held dream that if we just got 40 or so congressmen who would all vote as a block and watch each other's backs, you could stop a lot of the nonsense coming out of the House.
Yeah, exactly. It's the old idea that basically you don't need a majority of You need to have enough so that you become a bargaining wedge. And you can say, we're not just simply not going to do this legislation. You're not going to get us. Therefore, you're not getting your legislation. And they'll try all the tactics. Well, you're voting with the Democrats. You're doing this. You're doing that. And so, no, we're not voting with the Democrats. We're voting for our constituents. And unfortunately, some of these arguments get lost in all the political maneuvering, that the principle arguments. Instead, it comes down to, well, we've got to beat them. We got to beat them at their own game, and therefore you got to go with us on this bill. Just give us this bill. You give us this bill, we'll give you, it's the Charlie Brown, Lucy in the football. You give us this bill, you give us what we want on this bill and vote with us as a block on this, and we'll give you what you want. And when it comes time, the football gets pulled away every time. Or it's allowed to be amended, have the life amended out of the bill. Amendments that are allowed to come in that just simply destroy the entire purpose of the bill. So we see this over and over and over again. Some of these guys are starting to get savvy to it. And they're actually developing a core of guys who are willing to, guys and women, who are willing to stick together and say, you know, before it was simply people like Ron Paul voting by himself or with maybe one or two other people. And now it's if you can get 40 people who are in there, we're just not going to do that. And we're not going to be intimidated by the John Boehners and the House Whips and all these guys. And you know, you're not going to get chairmanships. Okay, don't give me a chairmanship.
Chuck, you just hit on something there, because that's the one way the House Freedom Caucus can end up becoming ineffective, and that is because you've already seen it happen. Guys like Trey Gowdy and others who have been awarded chairmanships, Jason Chaffetz as well, who were awarded chairmanships of subcommittees, and who then all of a sudden started talking more like the establishment than like the Freedom Caucus, and started voting that way too. It's interesting because that's one of the tools the establishment in control uses, is either the promise of or the threat of a chairmanship or loss thereof in order to make sure that everybody stays on the reservation with them. And you see it. I mean, yeah,
you see him change.
Chaffetz is doing it. I mean, and these are guys who supposedly are part of the Freedom Caucus. But again, it's the old adage that some of the political types that I run around with says, hey, there's an old adage in our business that when your friends get in a position where they can actually help you, they stop being your friends.
Well, our friend Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center, and if you don't know anything about American Policy Center, I would go to www.apc.com, APC, American Policy Center. Tom talks about the fact that he calls it drinking from the Potomac. And I've heard you use that phrase. I've used that phrase. They drink from the Potomac and it's poisonous. They like being in D.C. They like getting the perks. They like being able to get the extra money that they can hand out to help people's reelection. That's what happens when you're a committee chairman. Money from donors is trickled down to you to decide who to distribute it to help reelection campaigns. And that's how these chairmen gain such power. This is why you got guys like Mitch McConnell, who just really does not get what is happening. Really does not understand who's blaming talk radio for being quote-unquote unrealistic. about what conservatives expect when they don't hold the White House. Well, gosh, Mitch, how about when we held the White House in both houses? We didn't get what we expected.
No. It takes time. Chuck.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes time. You can't do this stuff overnight. You can't rush it. It's a process now. We have to, the honor of the institution has to be upheld. We have to do this in a right way because we've got to put our guys in power first.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm giving you the entire spin that you get from Republican leadership when they actually take control and then don't want to uphold any of the promises that they made to conservatives in order to get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning, Barry. It really is stunning what happens, and it's easy to see. I mean, okay, it's the old story. You compromise on a small thing. And then, well, you compromised on this. Can't you give me a little bit here? And you compromise on that thing. And then you got a bunch of small compromises that wind up being a big compromise. And hey, thanks for the help on that. Here's some money to dole out to some people who supported you in your sellout. Little by little by little by little. This is how John Kasich, who our friend Tom DeWeese once again said when yes. They worked together in the late 70s. On issues, and he said John Kasich was the real deal. He was truly a conservative and truly one of the good guys. And he said by the end of his second term in D.C. As a congressman in the Columbus area, he said he no longer knew who I was. He no longer was the same guy. He had completely flipped and become... He had drunk from the Potomac, had his brain poisoned, and had become a quote-unquote moderate. If you know anything about Kasich's record and you monitored it during the 80s, sometimes his ACU rating was as low as 50%. That's not very good for someone who was quote-unquote the real deal. And it was interesting that when a Republican regime was in, his voting record was terrible, and when a Democrat regime was in, it went up marginally. He got a little more conservative, and that's because he was selling it to the constituents.
Oh, sure. That's the way it works.
You know, he wanted to keep his job. This is the way this unfortunately happens. So what do you do about it? Well, you have to, first of all, please don't talk to me about term limits. I've got people, the term limits will save us. Term limits will save us. No, they won't. Because
no, they won't.
Barry, what has happened in the Ohio State House?
We've got term limits. It just speeds up the process of the despotism.
Well, not only that, what happens is you get guys who are decent people, really good representatives, and the Republican Party squeezes them out at the end of their term limit. They're not asked to run for the other house. They're not given cabinet positions to keep their name up front so they can run again. They're not given any help at all by the Republican Party and by the caucuses. And what then happens is these guys have to pull the burden all their own to get back in once they've sat out the end of that term limit.
Right. Now, Chuck, it's even happening before term limits now because the establishment has now lost patience with waiting for that 8-year period, at the most, for that rep to, you know, basically get in there and do what they're trying to do and flail about and then go home. So what they try to do now is, well, you know, if we got somebody who's not toeing the line, we'll refuse to give them endorsements in the primaries. We will cut off money, and we'll go out and recruit people to run against them in primaries. And yes, all of this has happened over the last number of years, and will continue to happen apace in the era of term limits. Because now with term limits, when someone climbs to a leadership position or to the top leadership positions, they want their agenda done like tomorrow. Because usually, Chuck, it takes them 4 years to get to the position, which means at the maximum they only have 4 years in order to exert their leadership upon the state. And if you've got a handful, you know, like a Freedom Caucus, at the state level who are withholding votes or introducing bills that are that make you uncomfortable, like, say, oh, I don't know, pastor protection or the heartbeat bill or prevailing wage repeal or project labor agreement fixes or tax reductions or spending freezes or zero-based budget. I could go on all day. When you start getting those people introducing those bills and making it uncomfortable for the establishment to glad hand and you know, soak up from the lobbyists and set up their next jobs, they start doing things in order to speed the process up. The taking away the endorsements, the taking away, you know, here's the dirty little secret, Chuck. And I don't care if people know this or not, because it's a known secret around state capital, is that when someone comes into the legislature, even as a candidate, they'll have a sit down with leadership, and leadership will basically tell them how much money leadership expects them to raise to give to the caucus coffers. In other words, they have to go back to their folks and to the lobbying world, and of course that's where the special interests, you know, right, play a big role. Because leadership will tell a, you know, a rookie freshman, well, we need you to raise $40,000 to give to the caucus now. Or a candidate, you know, first time candidate, well, you need to raise $25,000 and give it to ORUC, you know, which is the House Republican Campaign Committee, or the Democrats do this too. It's not just the Republicans, and it's this House and the Senate. You need to raise X number of tens of thousands of dollars and write it over to the campaign committee, and then we'll take care of you in the fall. We'll buy your media, you know, we'll post up, you will do your television and all that stuff for you. So basically it's like you're just parking your money here while we're putting it all together for you, like a, you know, a shopper's club almost.
Yeah.
But what usually happens is if that candidate or that that member falls for that, and then they go out on the stump and they do something like, you know, talk about how they're pro-life without exceptions, or, you know, how they want to get in there and repeal, you know, prevailing wage on public works or things of that nature, or they're against Common Core or some other issue that a big money special interest would be offended by, then, gee, when it gets right down toward the end of the campaign, all of a sudden they're getting these excuses from the campaign committees about why they can't afford to spend money in their district now. And a number of them lose because, you know, in those last few weeks, if you don't have the resources in order to message and to get out, you know, get your voters out, you don't win. And if you trust someone else in the establishment that will say that they'll do it all for you, but then they don't like what you do, guess what? You're probably not going to get that support. And what do you do at that point? I mean, you've already written the check.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote it on a bunch of promises. And I know members who won't write checks anymore to the caucus, and that's the reason why they don't get the endorsements, Chuck. That's the reason why they're withheld by the party, is because, well, you're not being a good team player.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I'm not raising this money for the team. I'm raising this money from folks in my district who want me in office to represent their interests. Not for me to hand you the money to go spend up in Cleveland or somewhere else to bring in a pro-death, pro-homosexual, pro-union, da-da-da-da-da, because you feel that you can pick up another number in your caucus tally by spending money up there and winning a swing district.
Right. This is the kind of thing that just drives people nuts. Now, look, it's also human nature. Unfortunately, it becomes, instead of becoming about holding a particular ideological position, it becomes more about winning. And in fact, you become willing to surrender your ideology in order to continue to win. And I understand the argument. Well, you can't get your agenda through if you can't get members. Well, if your members are against your agenda, you're not going to get your agenda through either. So basically what you're saying is there's something wrong with our agenda. We need to change our agenda. We need to become more like the other guys. And you'll notice that the other guys never have to become more like us, ever. They never talk in those terms, ever. It's only our side that does that. Barry, you see it not only in politics, you see it in places like the church. We have to become more like the culture in order to make sure that people come into the church. We need to be cater to the entertainment desires, because as you know, if we just get them in the doors, then they will become saved, and that's not quite really the way it works, is it?
You got it.
Basically, you get them in the door, and I can remember being a member of a church where people, we got to plug them into, they're a natural born leader, we got to plug them into a leadership position. You plug them into a leadership position, you find out they're a theological nightmare. Meanwhile, they're steering how the church teaches things and does things and events and that kind of thing. And that does not work. And that's exactly how theologically and ideologically you lose your church. You know, I'm not talking politically here. I'm talking about you end up with compromising churches. I mean, you end up with churches like the United Church of Christ, who came out, I think, yesterday or maybe day before yesterday. Again, this is Wednesday that we are recording this, and said that white people are racist by nature. All white people are racist, and they need to completely rethink the way they're doing things. Well, that's an absurd statement. I mean, you know, that's what's called that's a fallacy, and it's a glittering generality. And basically, what destroys those kinds of generalities is finding one example to the contrary, because that's an absolute statement that all white people are racist. Well, all you got to do is find one non-example, and it destroys the argument. Well, there are plenty of examples to show that that's just simply the stupidest statement, one of the stupidest statements ever made. And you know, we have to be vigilant in our churches that we don't want to become so much like the world that we become the world, and there's no discernible difference. And
well, Chuck, that's definitely something that, you know, we have to, as churches, as officers in the churches, as the pastors and the elders in churches, we constantly have to stay on guard for, because that's been the problem with the modern church, Chuck. It has been shaped into the mold of the world rather than the shaping the world in the mold of the faith in Christ.
Yes. And that's part of the problem. In fact, sometimes when you go into a church and you talk in those terms, our job is not to be shaped by the world, but to shape the world. Oh, how can you say that? Jesus never... of course he did.
You're one of those dominionists, aren't you?
Well, yeah. and that's what you get. Oh, how can you think that way? That means that you want to force people to do... I'm not interested in forcing anybody to do anything. What I want to do is create a world where people want to become that thing, that want to adopt Christian principles of how they're going to behave, and how they're going to behave both in public, in church, in private, the whole thing. People have to want to do that. That's the problem with certain, I'll go back to an example I love to use of prohibition, the prohibition of alcohol. Was that really a majority position? Well, no, obviously not, because what happened as soon as prohibition got passed? Well, everybody said this is an unjust law, and went about making sure they had ways to skirt it. People who were willing to skirt it sort of semi-legally basically got their doctor to write them a prescription for whiskey.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's a little medicinal nip that I'm going to take before I go to bed, blah, 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 blah. Other people just said, this thing is so unjust, we're just not going to do it. And what did it eventually lead to? Well, it gave organized crime, which before had basically been shoved off in a corner dealing with, gambling and prostitution. Now, all of a sudden, it gave them a huge business to make themselves giant money on. And then that giant money later, after prohibition ended, went into narcotics. So things have unintended consequences, and that's one of them. And the reason people didn't want prohibition was, A, even Christians were like, only certain brands of Christians were pro-prohibition. Most Christians were like, well, there's no prohibition against having alcohol in the Bible. And there isn't. We may get in trouble for that. But the fact is, there's no prohibition against drinking alcohol. In the, what's prohibited in the Bible is drunkenness.
Drunkenness. That's exactly right. And you can stay away from being drunken while still, you know, not becoming a teetotaler.
Exactly. You can have a glass of beer. You can have a drink. You can have a glass of wine. There's all kinds of ways, you know, that without being a drunkard. And we have to be careful when we add to the law, because drunkenness is forbidden. Yes. But you know, when you add to the law and you attempt to enforce things that were never designed to be enforced, what you end up doing is giving a free hand to people who are willing to violate the law. And in fact, are so willing to violate because they understand it's an unjust law. This is one of the things we're running into now, Barry. We have laws upon laws upon laws upon laws. The legislature is constantly passing laws. Why are all these laws necessary? Well, it's kind of an ugly circle because people are getting less and less, and they understand that more and more and more laws are coming in because people are less and less and less and less self-controlled. That's the entirety of you know, what the Christian church used to teach was that if you can control yourself, there's no need for all these laws.
True. Well, what's the old saying? By if men were, Madison. If men were angels, then no laws would be necessary.
That's right. That is a Madison. If it's not a direct quote, it's so close that you could hit it with a dart.
Exactly. Yeah, Chuck, it's interesting you're bringing this up because I just recently, you know, we're recording this, I said, on Wednesday, just yesterday on Tuesday, I was at an event at the State House that was put on by our friends over at Citizens for Community Values, and it was a prayer rally. And they invited pastors in from all over the state to come and pray on the steps of the state capitol for the country and our culture. And then after the prayer gathering, which had about 300 or so people show up, Chuck, it was kind of a nice day. It wasn't too hot. It was pretty windy, but otherwise it was a beautiful day down on downtown Columbus.
Yeah.
But right afterward, there was a luncheon for senior pastors and they brought in historian David Barton from Wall Builders. Now, you and I both have heard David Barton before on many issues. And this time around, he was talking about something that I felt, and it goes right along with what you're saying here, Chuck. He has been working with George Barna from the Barna Group, and for many of our listeners, that name is going to be somewhat familiar. George Barna does polling, and he polls relentlessly, Chuck. They have been polling now for 20, 30-some years. Barna has written a number of books on the state of the culture based upon what he's getting back from his polling. And so Barton has been working for the last few years with Barna on a massive polling project where they have been identifying and then polling Bible-believing churches. Now, Chuck, there's over 300,000+ churches in the United States, but not all of those are Bible-believing.
Right.
As a matter of fact, according to their data, only about 27% of those churches are actually Bible-believing churches. So about 1 in 4, Chuck, are actually those who would hold to what we consider Christian orthodoxy. In other words, they believe the basic doctrines and tenets of Christianity. And again, this does not count mosques or, you know, Jewish churches. It doesn't count anything except basically Catholic and Protestant evangelicals. You know, they're not counting Muslims, they're not counting Jewish, they're not counting
right.
Hindus, Jainists, things of that nature. They're looking at those who identify as Christian. And so, you know, you may sit there and think, well, gosh, I know in some communities there's like dozens of churches. That doesn't make sense if there's only 300,000. Well, if you sort out all of the ones who are not Christian churches, then you get to that. Now, with those, you sort down, and again, it's less 27% of, I think it was, I think you said 300 and maybe 17,000 churches that would be considered Christian churches, and of that, only 27% are Bible-believing. And again, when George Barna says Bible-believing, they actually, their standards are pretty strict. I've seen their polling. They have, like, there's basically, they recognize at least 14 core fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith. And they poll on this stuff all the time to see where the culture is. You know, if you call yourself a Christian, are you a born-again Christian? You know, and do you believe these tenets of the faith? Well, Chuck, I remember seeing a poll 15 years ago or more that Barna took a large sampling poll. I mean, these are ones where the margins of error are in the 3% ranges, not in the 4% ranges, you know. So really solid polling that showed that even of those who considered themselves to be born-again Christians, only about 3% held to all of the 14 basic doctrines of Christian orthodoxy. So you're looking at a situation where even 15 years ago, Bible-believing, it was a little bit tougher to get your finger on because they were believing parts of the Bible, but maybe not believing certain other parts. But, okay, so give that as it is. We've got these Bible-believing churches, and so they did some intensive polling. And what they did was they went to the members of those churches, and they polled these church members. And, of course, they did a sampling across the country of the what is 27% of 300,000? It would be like 80,000 churches, maybe?
About 82,000, something like that.
Okay, 82,000 churches. So they did, and they're doing it daily, and they're doing about 1,600 a day. And they're asking that, and they've got, you know, basically, like, to identify for importance, like, they came up with a list of 150 things that the Bible touches on, you know, in the culture, you know, because the Bible does speak to everything. Chuck, you and I both know that.
Right.
But they came up with a list of 150 different items, and then they asked these, as a poll, they asked them people to rank them at, you know, 1 to 5 on the amount of, you know, hey, I don't need any other information on that, I'm good, or I would like to have a little bit more information, or it would be important to me to have more information, or, you know, I really feel I've got to have a lot more information, or it's absolutely critical that, you know, this is talked about in the pulpit. And that's what they're asking is, of these issues, where, you know, if your pulpits are talking about them, you know, how critical is it to you? And then so they sorted this all out, and they've been sorting it out for a while, and they came up with, like, their top 10 or 12. He said 14, but then he wouldn't reveal what 13 and 14 were, because Barna and Barton have written a book called U-Turn, and you can get that all in the book. But I'm not here to pump a book, so I'll just talk to you about the first couple or so that he recognized. And number one, I mean, honestly, of the ones that people of the parishioners and Bible-believing churches said that it was critical that they had more or better information on how to give a defense, what do you think number one was, Chuck?
Oh, gosh. I wouldn't even, honestly, at this point, I wouldn't even venture a guess.
Okay, it was abortion.
Okay.
Now, you think about how many churches have pro-life committees, how many churches, you know, recognize the unborn, how many churches, you know, say life is precious. But we've got parishioners out there who their number one issue across the board that they think it's critical that they receive better training and information on how to respond to. In other words, forming an apologetic, giving reasons for why they're pro-life is number one. Number two is marriage. You know, no-fault divorce, same-sex marriage, the whole nine yards. What does the Bible actually say so that they can talk to people that they run into about these issues? These are the ones they feel are critical that they have got to have better information on. Now they went back. Now what they did was once they started getting this data in, they started thinking, okay, maybe we should take this to another level. And so what they did was they went back around and then they surveyed the pastors of these Bible-believing churches. And they basically said, because they sorted down, they got a list of 14 items. And they basically sent it around and said, you know, which of these items have you addressed to your congregation? And, he looked at the first couple of them, but, you know, abortion, 67% of the churches, the pastors and churches said, yes, we deal with that issue, you know, in our sermons, etc. But then when they thought, okay, well, let's add another layer to this. Let's go back around and ask all the parishioners, how often have you heard or have you heard these issues discussed in the pulpit? Funny thing, Chuck, of this one on abortion, 67% of the pastors are saying they're preaching on it, but only 43% of the parishioners have said that they've heard anything about it.
Well, you know what may be going on is that the pastor thinks he's preaching on it, but he's not talking about it in direct terms.
Hey, thank you. And again, we can give a little bit on the percentages because, you know, that may have been the Sunday that somebody, you know, was off on vacation or
right.
The kids were sick or the car broke down. And so they missed it that day of the one time in the 5 years that the pastor actually talks about this issue. You know, and again, it's a situation. And, you know, Barton was saying that two pastors, in order to drive home a point that, you know what, back during our founding era, you look at the sermons. And there were sermons on everything from earthquakes to you know, the moral use of railroads to
yep.
To who to pick for president. You know, the things that today pastors and churches would shy away from because they'd be afraid of losing their nonprofit status. You know,
well, Barry, I think you and I both have a copy of a book called Sermons from the Revolutionary Era or
right. Or the sermons of the founding era.
Founding
yeah,
era,
right.
Yeah. I mean, and you read these things, they are not avoiding politics.
Oh, not by a long shot. And as a matter of fact, that you know, what he got down to a point was is that when it talks about training children up in the way they should go, our modern translations kind of butcher the word.
Yeah.
Because the word in Hebrew is not train, it's catechize. It's to give them a series of questions and they memorize and memorize answers so that they are well equipped, you know. And he said in the 17 and 1800s, he goes, I've got copies. I've got catechisms on mathematics, catechisms on mechanical, you know, motion, catechisms on, I mean, on agriculture. He goes, that's how they taught because that's how it sticks with people and how they do not, you know, they do not run away from it or they will return to it when they grow. Or as it says, train a child up in the way he should go. And when he is old, he will not depart from it.
I can remember having this discussion with a pastor in a church I used to be a member of. And I talked about memorizing, you know, catechisms. And he said, well, if you think that's valuable. And I said, you know what?
It's biblically commanded.
That's right. If you get into a situation, like you go to a college and you go to a secular college or, in many cases, a Christian college, and you are presented with something in which one of those questions and answers that you memorized, you are prepared because that will come back into your head. Hey, wait a minute. Doesn't it mean this? Are you talking about this? If you have no basically vault to go to pull up answers or to pull up things that you've memorized to understand those things, you're sunk. You got nothing.
Right. And I think that's the thing that I came away with from this luncheon speech that Barton gave, because, you know, I've heard Dave Barton a lot on the historical and seeing the sermons and things, but when he hit on that idea that the Bible commands we catechize as part of our discipleship, and not just discipling of, okay, I know what John 3:16 says, I know what, you know, each Bible verse says, but catechizing the application of biblical truth to everything we do in life, which, you know, we call that a biblical worldview, Chuck. And he's right, because now, you know, we basically go to Bible college or Sunday schools and we consider that training, but honestly, you know, and I do this with my kids, too. After we hear a sermon, I wait, you know, about a half an hour or so after as we're heading home, and I say, okay, guys, tell me what was going on in the sermon. You know, what did you get out of it? What was the key points? Why were we talking about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, you have to do that kind of thing or else, you know, like many other things, it comes in, it bounces around, and then it dissipates out like mist, and you never... It never sinks in.
Yep.
And I think too many people, and I think this study by Barna and Barton are proving it, too many people are warming pews. They're not building their faith.
Right. Well,
and too many pastors are just preaching around the edges and hoping that it won't offend anybody so that they leave and take their tithe with them, or they really just don't understand that the Bible is completely equipped to answer all of the questions of the day. Yeah.
Well, we have to end on that note because we are out of time for this week. Seems like we just get going and really get into a subject, and then we got to go. You now know what we think about these issues. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. You'll be able to hear an archived version of this program. www.principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.